You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter. On a wonderful Davis day, you notice I didn't say sunny. It's kind of overcast, but not raining at the moment.
When I woke up,
is it going to rain, Don?
Yes, it is. When I woke up, it was bright and clear out here in Guano County. It was beautiful. And by the way, it was 34 degrees, just so you all know. And there was visible frost on the ground on the farm. I doubt if people in town had much visible frost, just because of the amount of moisture. And of course, you're a little warmer in the urban areas. But we're cold, and we're going to be cold this coming week. Cold enough that it's not tomato planting season. Is it time to plant tomatoes? No. We'll come back to that topic.
Plant anything?
Yes, it's a great time to plant leafy greens and things like that. Temperature right now at the University Airport, as Lois and I are preparing this show on February 18th for broadcast on February 19th, 2026, is 43 degrees, going up to a high today of 49 degrees, which is the lowest high temperature we've had in the last several days. It's going to cloud over again, partly sunny, a chance of rain today. Tonight will be cloudy with a chance of rain leading to rain, and it will only be 38 degrees because of the cloud cover. Thursday, day of the broadcast, again, only 48 degrees is the high. It will rain on Thursday. It will be mostly clear Thursday night, and I'm reading this to you. This is the first I've seen this, and the low Thursday night will be 29 degrees.
Oops.
Okay, that will, if it happens, be the coldest night we've had this winter. 29 degrees Thursday night. We'll see. What that means is there's very cold air coming in behind the storm that's just passing over us, and then it's going to clear out, and the heat will be lost to the sky from all the surfaces, and we will have our coldest morning of the winter of 2026. Should Friday, a high will be 48 degrees and mostly sunny. So sunny and cold. Friday night, mostly cloudy, but 35 degrees Friday night. So no, it's not time to plant tomatoes. Saturday, the high will be 53 degrees, a chance of rain. Rain kind of coming in on Saturday. Rain very likely Saturday night with a low only 44 on Saturday night. Sunday, it just plain says rain, cloudy, high near 57. Sunday night, a little warmer storm coming in. Rain with a low of 50 Sunday night. Monday, rain. 59, so it's like warming pattern here. Monday night, rain will only get down to 48, and Tuesday, rain. But none of these rain are going to be what we just went through. According to the National Weather Service, we got a little over an inch of rain here, which was the lowest total anywhere around us. I'm looking at the California Nevada River Forecast Center site. And there was a lot of rain over in the Marin Headlands. Up in Marin Headlands, they got 5 to 6 inches of rain. Wow. That's Point Reyes, that whole area. Up in Wine Country, anywhere from 3 to 4.5 inches of rain. For all of you Lake Berryessa watchers waiting for the overflow, Lake Berryessa is now about 2 feet below the overflow hole, the glory hole, as they call it. And my recollection is early on in the season, each inch of rain raises the lake level about a foot. As we get closer to overflow, it's a very, very broad lake. Lake Berryessa is a very large geographic area. It's more like 1 inch of rain raises the lake level 6 to 7 inches. So they only need 3 to 4 more inches of rain up around Lake Berryessa, and it will be overflowing, and people will be driving up there to take pictures of it. I know there are places where the lake is overflowing would be a calamitous emergency. Here it's a tourist attraction. People love to look at it because it does look like a giant bathtub. Anyway, they're probably 3 inches away from overflow up there.
So before that happens, if you were to go to the dam and not go up the hill to the dam, but look at the creek as it's coming out the bottom,
yeah, beautiful,
you might find, ooh, a bird that walks underwater.
Which bird is that?
A dipper.
Ah, okay. The other thing you might find, someone told me they were up there, newts. Newts are out. They like this kind of weather. And we have a native newt that migrates during the rainfall period here. So watch your step. They're big. You can't miss them. So the amount of rainfall that we're looking at over the next few days, the weather underground always tends to be a little high on these things. So these are perhaps the outlying numbers. Saturday, maybe a tenth of an inch. Sunday, about a third of an inch. Monday, about a third of an inch. Tuesday, about a third of an inch. Wednesday, about a quarter of an inch. And then clearing up for next weekend. So this weekend, cold, rainy. Cold nights tonight and tomorrow, and then a warming trend, 65 degrees a week from Friday. So we'll be back in nice gardening weather, but still too early to plant tomatoes. This actually came up with basil. Someone was asking me, you know, I know what you say about tomatoes and peppers and all that kind of thing. Where does basil fit into all that? I don't want the nights below 50 for basil. I like to give people rules of thumb. No, it's not absolute. I'm sure the varieties differ somewhat. I'm sure your local environment may be a little different. But when you bring basil into a garden center and the nights are getting into the upper 30s to low 40s, it's not happy about it. The plant does not like that. It injures the plant, in fact. Not like direct frost injury, just cold damage. We've talked about this multiple times this year, because what we're seeing this year, other than what might happen two nights from now, has just been sustained cold damage. It wasn't freezing, but when we had temperatures in the low 40s, subtropical and tropical plants were showing injury anyway. It wasn't direct freezing injury. It was literally damage from the fact that these are subtropical and tropical plants being exposed to temperatures that are less than optimal. You can start to get injury on the leaf. You'll see it. It's visible. You'll get spots on the leaves. The roots are being damaged. So I don't even like to bring any of these things in until the nights are consistently above 50 degrees. If we do, we put them in our greenhouse. And we have found that's a subtle hint that maybe it's too cold for them to be outside. Do you have basil? Yes, it's in the greenhouse. Oh, does it need to be in a greenhouse? Yes. Do you have a greenhouse at home? No. Well, then how about if you wait until it's warmer and we'll have it then too? I absolutely guarantee it. But that's a good rule of thumb. 50 degrees for a lot of these subtropical plants. Below that, it's injuring them. So you're not gaining anything with early planting. It turns out sometimes we're having this conversation. They want to grow it indoors. Well, basil is not real successful indoors, but go ahead, have fun, stick it in your window, you know, see how it works out. But in general, at this time of year, we're probably about a month away from selling basil. We're probably 6 weeks away from it being appropriate to put it out in the ground. Maybe you have a location close to your house. You could put it, you know, in a pot near the door, or you could just wait till it's warmer. But 50 degrees at night is a good threshold. KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And we have a few announcements here.
Quite a few, actually. I was looking at this UC Davis Biodiversity Museum Day, and it's got all these different museums that are participating, and they're all over campus. The Anthropology Museum, the Arboretum and Public Garden, Bee Haven, Bohart, Botanical Conservancy, California Raptor Center, Center for Plant Diversity, Design Museum, Museum of Wildlife and Fish Biology, and Nematode Collection, Paleontology Collection.
Wait. Let's go see the Nematode Collection. That's great. That's really interesting. They are pretty
sick. So the Yeast Culture Collection.
There you go.
What? Well, that has to do with brewing, actually. Well, and then there's a speaker series, and there's a whole bunch of things. Saturday, the 21st of February.
Yep. That's one of some of our favorite organizations there, Bohart Museum of Entomology, Raptor Center. The web link for this is biodiversitymuseumday.ucdavis.edu. And all the programs are on there. Some of these folks are having specific events. Some of them are open for certain hours, mostly 12 to 4 p.m. But the Bee Haven is open from 9 to 1 p.m. So check it out. That is biodiversitymuseumday.ucdavis.edu. First, a little quick announcement. If you were following along a couple weeks ago, maybe it was last week, we talked about all the trees that are flowering around the area. Came up because someone had taken video of trees and they were blaming Pyrus kawakami as if they were Bradford pears. Well, the Pyrus kawakami is still in full bloom. Bradford pears are now blooming as well. So that funky smell as you're walking around downtown, which was mild with the Pyrus kawakami, is now rather pronounced with the Bradford pears. They're blooming. The Prunus bleriana, the flowering plum, is still blooming. And my flowering quince, which is a shrub, but that's come into bloom. Plums are blooming now. And I just wanted to mention that you can see pictures of these at my Instagram page. So if you want to see which trees we're talking about, go to Instagram.com/Don.Shore, S-H-O-R, and you can follow along there and you'll see some other pictures of things that are blooming at this time of year as well. It's a fairly bleak time out in the garden for a lot of folks. So it's nice to know that there are things that will give us color right now. I have pictures of some of the narcissus that are in bloom. We've got Virginia blooming and here and there, the Eureops daisy is in bloom. I have a Butylon in bloom. It literally blooms year round, as Lois can tell you. It's something that blooms pretty much all the time. So there are plants that will give us flowers in the middle of winter, not just annuals or bulb things like cyclamen, but there are shrubs, woody plants, Ribes malvaceum, the chaparral currant, a Southern California native, is in bloom right now. It's beautiful flowers on that one. And the hummingbirds are very attracted to that as well. So there are things you can plant to give December, January, February bloom. Some trees, very early blooming ones, some perennials, some shrubs. So you want to see some examples. What I do each day on my Instagram page, roughly, is I post a picture of whatever was in bloom. Or today I posted a picture, something we'll talk about a little bit later, blood oranges, which are ripening right now.
Hey, Don, are red hot pokers blooming now?
They're finishing. Red hot poker, there's two basic types. There's winter blooming and summer blooming. Used to be that the only red hot pokers you could buy anywhere were Nepophia uvaria, which is a summer blooming member of the genus. So that's the one everybody knows. That's the one that's around old farmhouses. These are plants that absolutely take care of themselves. Red hot poker is an indestructible perennial. There is a series. There are species from South Africa that bloom in the winter, and they've been hybridizing in with some other species to get some great garden hybrids. Christmas cheer, as the name suggests, blooms in December. I always go out on New Year's Eve and take a picture of the Christmas cheer Nepophia on my property, which is blooming in late December and into January. They're finishing up now, and I'll tell you one little thing about these. If you're into songbirds, I was watching all the beautiful seeds forming on the bloom spikes thinking, I'll go out and gather those seeds and grow some of these from seeds.
And somebody got ahead of you, didn't they?
Yeah, I went out there and there weren't any seeds left. And as I walked up, little songbirds of something I'm sure you could identify went flying away and they'd eaten all the seeds. So let's put it this way. You can grow Nepophia to draw hummingbirds to the flowers and apparently various forms of songbirds to the seeds. Now, I use the term songbirds very generically. I don't know which birds they were, but they were eating the seeds of my Nepophia.
So my plum is now blooming spectacularly. Last week there was one flower open. Now the tree is covered with flowers, but it's not covered with bees.
No, it's kind of cold.
It's been raining.
Yeah.
So does that mean I'm not going to get any plums?
Well, fortunately, blooms on plums. I had the same question about almonds. The first variety of almonds, the best one, Nonpareil, I'm pretty sure is the one I'm seeing, are in full bloom. If you happen to want to take some pictures, this is a great time. Drive carefully and don't pull off on the shoulder. You might get stuck. But the first of the almonds, the main crop one, is in full bloom right now. The bee boxes are out there. Someone asked me, boy, with this weather and these temperatures, what are the almond growers looking at? I said, well, they go through this every year. Being an almond grower is a little dicey in this region because they do start blooming in the second to third week of February, and their entire bloom period is pretty much done here by the first week or so of March. In that time period, it's usually sunny enough, usually clear enough and warm enough for some period of the bloom for them to get adequate pollination. No, when it's below 50, or cloudy or raining, European honeybees are not flying. They're very fickle little animals, and they don't like to go out when it's cold or wet. And so they're not getting pollination on a day like today. They weren't getting pollination yesterday with the storm that we had. But if we do, if the clouds break and we get into the 50s, by the end of the day, there could be some bee activity out there. And if you look at your plum, you realize you have several thousand flowers there. And you only need several hundred fruit. So you only need a certain percentage of them to actually get pollinated to get adequate results. We have had years where we have consistent, persistent rainfall and low night temperatures where we don't get good fruit set. And that could happen. But I'm looking at the weather and I'm guessing that they probably got some pollination 2 days ago. They'll probably get some tomorrow, So it's intermittent. One of the reasons you always plant, if you're an almond grower, 3 to 4 varieties is for insurance. When we planted our almond orchard, they told us, we plant, here are the four that you plant. The one, nonpareil, is your high value one. You get more money per pound for that than for the others. The others are usually listed on our payment as pollinators. Their nuts are fine. They're used for many things. Some of them are better for candy. Some of them are, they are sold, but you didn't get as much money for them as for the nonpareil. So why not plant nothing but nonpareil? One, it needs a pollinizer. And two, it's an early bloom. And so if you have 7 to 8 days of rain early in the bloom season of your almond, you won't get a crop on it that year. But if you've got some that bloom a little bit later and a little bit later and a little bit later, at least one or two of them are almost sure to produce well. So you have 3 to 4 varieties in there typically for insurance. Even though it's a lower value variety, you'll get nuts in a year when the early rain might have affected the nonpareil. So that you will see a long bloom season in almonds, but it's not all the same variety blooming that you're seeing out there over the 2 to 3 week bloom period. Right now, peak of bloom, there's lots of people out there. I see this, and so I wanted as a public service announcement. The farmers don't really like it if you drive into their orchards. Two, we've had a couple inches of rain, so there's a pretty good chance you'll get stuck. So don't drive off of asphalt or concrete onto mud in the valley right now. And walking out there, be careful. Maybe you can get stuck. It's muddy and slippery and wet, and there's bees out there. So take your pictures carefully. Use your zoom feature on your camera, not your feet, and preferably stay out of the orchard. You can still get some really good pictures without having to drive or walk off the main road. For your own safety, just keep that in mind.
This is from Ben, who is in, where did I say it was?
Southern California.
Southern California. Okay. And he's got a bunch of questions. We won't do all of them, but he had pictures with some of them. Thank you so much for sending the pictures. What is wrong with my Western red bud? I planted it in late spring of 2025, and it was doing great until recently. My hunch is that I had it on a weekly drip line until just recently, and it was too much water for the winter months. Maybe I should just hold off supplemental watering or moderate it. What do you think? And then the pictures. And the pictures show a small Western red bud, and the edges are sort of a rusty brown, I would call them leathery.
None of that mattered as much to me as the fact that it's February and your Western redbud has leaves on it. So this was perplexing to me because Western redbud is a deciduous plant. And in my area here in the Davis area, they're completely bare right now. So it's a little surprising to see leaves on your Cirsus occidentalis in February. Perhaps it never dropped its leaves this year. I don't know if that's typical. Those of you in Southern California, let me know. Does Western redbud not form a proper abscission layer and drop its leaves? The injury that I'm seeing on these leaves is environmental. That's what I can tell you. The marginal burn suggests to me actually that in late summer or fall, and this is common in Southern California because of your weather patterns, our weather patterns down there where Santa Ana winds occur in October, and we may not even see rainfall until, who knows, November, December. Probably inadequate soil moisture late in the season was the cause of this marginal burn on them. Western redbud leaves can look rough even in their native habitat. This is one of the things that I want people to know about this plant. It's a wonderful native. It has beautiful blooms here very early in the season, and bees absolutely love them. But the foliage can look rough in our climate just due to extreme heat. The leaves can burn, the edges can burn, the plant's fine. It's just a cosmetic thing. Same thing in Southern California. My guess is what I know about the soils down there. There was probably a late season period of inadequate irrigation. Not frequency, duration is what I'm concerned about. And it's a young plant. It was just planted last year, so it was just getting established. So this will probably be less and less of a problem as time goes by. But one thing to remember is that the leaves on Western redbuds very commonly we'll get a little burn, a little marginal burn or spotting. In our area, when we have extreme heat events, we get spotting on the leaves. It's an edema. It's just a physiological reaction to the extreme heat. None of that's harming the plant. It just is affecting the aesthetics of it.
All right, his second question. I did a grave disservice to this lemon. I watered it and mulched it, which I do not think any previous plant companion had done. The result was way too many fruit, and now I have this split in one of the main branches. Can this be salvaged, or is it time to cut this half of the tree off? I would like to encourage lower branching. What is the strategy here? And looking at the pictures, I've never seen a split like that, Don. Does that look normal to you?
Yeah, it looks normal for when you had too much fruit. And so the weight of the fruit caused the branch to bend over, and then a bunch of vertical fissures formed. I guess they're vertical. Vertical fissures formed up and down the branch. They can heal. they could also get infected. And so this is a concern. Citrus can heal pretty readily. This whole branch had obviously a whole lot of fruit on it and was hanging down and split. And it hasn't split to the point of breaking. In fact, it looks like it could probably hold itself together. So you could wait and see if this plant will heal itself, which it will do probably without any infection. You never know. If we get a really wet spell, you could get infection in these long, long areas of injury. Up here, we've been seeing citrus blast, citrus brown rot a little bit this year. These are diseases that can infect through leaves, through tender growth, and through breaks in the bark like this. I don't know if that's likely to be as much of a problem in a drier interior climate in Southern California, but it could happen. The thing is what to do about it. If you're concerned about the safety of this plant maybe falling apart, and it does look like it's waiting way out over into the path, if you did cut it off or cut it way back, one of the rare cases where a heading cut might be appropriate, pretty much guarantee that a new shoot's going to come up either where you cut or a little further down on the plant, and the tree will balance itself out. My experience with citrus is that they're pretty amenable to pruning. There's a lot of places where they're pruned hard in Europe and in desert areas where they grow them as ornamentals. They'll prune them like hedges, or they'll clip them as little formal things in the landscape. And you do sometimes do hard pruning on them. When you do that, the consequence of hard pruning on citrus is a vigorous shoot coming up at the point of the cut or further down. And that will be not necessarily juvenile, but it's likely to take at least 2 to 3 years to start flowering and fruiting. But on the other hand, it will balance the tree and you won't have this collapsing problem. So if it were mine, I'd probably grin and bear it, take some nice clean loppers and cut that off. And then let the tree grow out and do a little shaping and pruning in the next 1 to 2 years as it fills back in somewhat on that side. You're also going to have a light crop this year, very likely. If you had a heavy crop last year, it looks like a Meyer lemon. They can get very much into an alternate bearing pattern. So this is maybe a good opportunity to do this anyway, knowing that you're sacrificing some crop. It'll just be a light year for it. And you can work a little bit on rebalancing this tree. They will send up shoots almost anywhere you cut to. So there's a good chance you can restore the structure of this tree if you're willing to make that one big cut that I'm looking at right here, where you're just going to go ahead and head it back or take it all the way back to where this branch arises and then see what happens next year when new growth comes along.
Don, if you look at the middle of the three pictures, there's the place where the two main shoots go left and right.
Yep.
And there is an upright shoot coming out there. That could be a new leader, new header.
And it's not even really a leader in the case of Meyer lemon. They don't form a single trunk tree anyway. That will promptly become more vigorous there, and pretty good chance right below where you cut a shoot will come up as well. So they tend to balance themselves. I've had to do severe pruning on citrus on my property occasionally. 1990. Anybody remember the freeze of 1990? And we got to 16 degrees in Dixon. And my kumquat tree was fine. My navel orange 20 feet away was completely top killed. I didn't know if it was even going to come back at all. So we went ahead and we just stubbed it. Took a chainsaw, cut it down to about 4 feet. And it promptly resprouted everywhere we had cut and grew back very vigorously. It took about 3 to 4 years, is my recollection, for it to start flowering and fruiting again. But within just a few years, it was back up to about the same size it had been before and had balanced itself very nicely. Citrus will tend to do this. If there's a gap in the canopy, a shoot will come up and fill that gap. Look at it closely. One, make sure it's not coming from below the graft. Meyer lemons are very commonly on their own roots, so that's not usually an issue. But other citrus, watch and make sure nothing comes up from below the graft. Because when I had to head back that navel orange, the whole north side cambium had been destroyed on this plant by those low temperatures. And everything that came up on the north side of the tree was root sucker and had to be removed and still has to be removed all these years later, keeps coming up on that side. So check carefully as to where the new shoots are coming from. For several years after that major freeze, we were looking at oranges and lemons and things with people, their pictures, and saying, it's all rootstock. You lost your top. So watch carefully as to where they're coming from. If they come up from above the graft union, or in the case of something like a Meyer lemon, which is on its own roots, if they're very vigorous, angular stems, thorns on them, that's juvenile wood. If it's above the graft, or the case of a rooted plant like the Meyer, it's still what you planted, but it will also be 3 to 5 years probably before it flowers or fruits. So keep that in mind. You may decide to remove those if you don't want to wait that long for that part of the tree. Here you've got good wood on one side that's obviously got fruit on it. I can see it in the picture. What will happen if you prune this back is you'll probably get some vigorous growth on that side of the tree. Within a year or two, you wouldn't even know that that branch had been lost because it'll balance itself out very nicely.
Okay, a third question, and this has to do with pruning avocados. I won't read the whole thing, but there's two pictures of avocado trees.
Yeah.
And the question is...
I'm jealous. Look at these things.
So it says, the Kona Charwell avocado has incredible lower branches. Could they be secondary or tertiary central leaders? And how would you do that?
Sure, you can allow them to grow. Just make sure that they're well positioned with respect to each other. So what I like to see is branches placed at least a foot apart going up the trunk, so they're not two branches coming out at the same point. If something is going out horizontally more than about 45 degrees, I would probably shorten that up. In other words, looking at this one as an example and the picture of the whole tree, a branch going off to the right is already out at about 30, 45 degrees. And going to get longer, so it'll start to weight down, could become horizontal, could become structurally unsound. So I would shorten that up a couple feet. That's all you do. You prune them to shape, you prune them for size control, and be real careful when you're pruning not to expose the interior trunk to direct sun unless you're prepared to whitewash it, which has been done on this tree. I can see that. So it's been painted to prevent sunburn.
And I'm going to end with his PS. He says, as always, thank you both for your insights. And PS, I sympathize with your AI skepticism, but before you irreparably antagonize our robot overlords, check out extension.bot. And this is the Oklahoma State Extension has created a bot to answer your questions, and it is trained only and exclusively on extension materials and scientific research from universities and such. Yeah. So, hey, there's one bot that's got good training.
Yeah, Oklahoma State, okstate.edu extension. Check out the extension bot. I appreciate these leads for useful online resources because, boy, am I getting frustrated, let me tell you. Okay.
All right. Mm-hmm. This is from Josh, who is... I think in Davis here.
Mm-hmm. I believe so, yeah.
I said, I'm working on a drainage issue in a curved planting bed along our neighborhood greenbelt, and I'd really appreciate your perspective. After heavy winter storms, I've noticed seasonal pooling in a narrow strip along a curved concrete lawn edge. Yep. It only happened several times over the last 2 years, but I recently planted a bare root red barren peach in that bed, and I want to address the grading thoughtfully before spring growth accelerates.
Okay.
So he sent pictures.
Yeah, great picture because it's obviously was taken after some recent rainstorm and there is standing water there. So this is my key question. Does the water stand there for more than a couple hours? After the rains have passed, does it drain out within 12 hours? The old drainage test that we were taught years and years ago is to see if your soil has good drainage. You dig a hole and you fill it with water. And if it drains out within 24 hours, you don't have a drainage problem. So in the winter, the pathogens that we talk about a lot on the Davis Garden Show, primarily Phytophthora cinnamomai, the root and crown rot pathogen, that requires warm temperatures with standing water. It is not an issue in cold temperatures with standing water. Again, I'm on a farm and we had several acres of almonds. And in early to mid 1990s, 1995, I remember this, we had major flooding here. And we had 1 to 2 feet of water backing up over about 2 to 3 acres of almonds. Indeed, it was backing up towards the house. So we were watching with considerable interest to see what would happen. And it was a lake for about 3 days. And then the storms passed and it drained out and there was no harm to any of those almond trees. Okay. So even standing water in cold, cold winter weather is not that big an issue. We want it to drain away, and I want to make sure it does drain away. It looks to me, looking at this great picture, that it will flow past this tree and out onto the sidewalk, and you might want to accommodate that, but I'm not particularly concerned about the tree unless this water is still there a week later. There are parts of Davis, a few, where the soil has been so abused during the period of subdivision or during the process of building the house, or it's just plain really heavy soil, Binning Tract, North Davis Meadows, some of you in parts of Stonegate where the lake soil was spread out 50 years ago. Those are areas where you might actually have standing water for more than 12 to 24 hours, but that would be pretty uncommon in our area. So this advice here is sort of, you know, I realize we have listeners all over the place. For Davis, even though we have high density, and water can only soak in, let's say, a half inch at a time, it does soak in. So I'm not real concerned about the water that I'm seeing in this picture. But in a situation like this, it's actually pretty easy to accommodate this excess water. You can either do a French drain, which is not that complicated, or a sump type thing. French drain is where you dig a trench and you'd go out and get that perforated tubing. You've seen it, 4-inch perforated plastic tubing, usually has, as I say, perforated, so it has holes in it. You dig a trench, you put that in there, you cover it with some gravel, and it fills up with surplus water and drains it away somewhere. So that's the key decision, is where is that somewhere going to be? So you want to take the water perhaps away from being around the tree to a lower point, a little further down. Fine, that's what you can do. Or you can just choose where that somewhere is right now. We did this for a customer when they were having a problem with their neighbor irrigating way too much and water was standing around their cherry tree multiple times during the summer. Well, that'll kill a cherry tree. Water standing in the summer, bad news. And then we couldn't get the neighbor to stop watering and we had no place for the water to drain away. We couldn't like channel it off to the street or anything like that. So we took a post hole digger. And if I were looking at your picture here where this red barren peach is, I'd probably go up 3 to 4 feet towards the fence. And we dug down as deep as we could go with that post hole digger, which is about 3 to 4 feet down. And we widened it out as best we could. We backfilled that hole with coarse cobble, not gravel, a little bigger size. I'm sure gravel would probably work, but we went one step up, you know, 1-inch cobble type of thing. And that way, whenever the neighbor watered, we could watch it happening. The water would flow in, flow down into this spot, which we called the sump. It would take a long time to fill that up before it would finally overflow. And most of the water was now standing 3 to 4 feet from the trunk of the cherry tree, which saved the cherry. So you can simply redirect where the water stands, or you can redirect where the water goes. If you redirect where it goes, obviously you have to plan at that end where the French drain goes, what's going to happen there. We would rather, this is kind of new thinking, we would rather not have you draining this out over the sidewalk into the storm drain system. I mean, it's designed to accommodate that, but it'd be better if it can go to a low point that you've chosen and it will pool there and soak in so that the water soaks in whenever you have a surplus and benefits the trees and the shrubs nearby, helps to recharge the water in your area rather than going into the city storm drain system and going away somewhere. So far better. And landscape architects are getting trained on this now. I'm seeing it in a lot of new landscaping, planning for where the low spots are going to be, planning for where the water is going to collect so that it will stay on site rather than going off site if you possibly can do that. You may not have room for that here, or you might be able to accommodate it with just two sumps like I'm describing, where you just make a big hole and fill it with something to collect excess water. Any 1 to 2 inch rainstorm, that would probably be sufficient. Yeah, we got 3 to 4 inches of rain, it's going to be flowing off, but as long as it drains off within 12 to 24 hours, I'm not real concerned about it.
So the current plan is to slightly lift and feather the low strip along the concrete edge. And he said he's thinking about raising the peach 4 to 6 inches on a broad mound.
Okay, hold on. Let me look real quick. I think your peach is okay. I think your elevation on that is fine. It looks like it's a couple inches above the grade. It's just a matter of making sure the water isn't standing right under the tree.
And it's the entire area is slightly sloped.
Yeah. Yes.
So
I'm not worried about the peach as far as that goes. Yeah.
And then plant the swale area with Juncus patens, Douglas iris, and Carex ponza to handle intermittent winter moisture while remaining summer appropriate.
Yeah, those are sedges and reeds. Those are all, well, the two of them, Juncus and the Carex, are both suitable. They can tolerate standing water. They can also tolerate a fair bit of drought. These are some of these very adaptable native grass-like plants that we use. Some people even use them as lawn substitute. And there's other Carex you could look at, Carex pragracillus, Carex tumulicola. There's others that would be suitable. Most of those are a fairly permanent decision, I'm told, by people who have planted them. They're hard to get rid of if you change your mind, but they look kind of like turf and they make a nice appearance. Douglas iris are a wonderful plant. In the valley, my experience is 3 to 4 years is sort of their lifespan. they may not be happy about this amount of moisture. So I would put them a little upslope, and they're best in my experience where they get a little bit of light shade. They don't absolutely need light shade right away. And assuming your peach grows, that would provide what they're after. It's a really good choice near trees, because the Douglas iris or Pacific irises can take bright shade, morning sun, even into the early afternoon, and they can tolerate sun later part of the day, but they tend to look pretty rough in the summer if they get that. There's a couple of varieties, and this often happens with California natives. There's a couple of cultivars that have just proven to be really adaptable. And in the case of the Pacific iris or Douglas iris, is Canyon Snow. It's a white one that lots of growers, even growers who don't even barely do native plants, are growing that one. Just seems to be particularly well adapted. It's a pretty short list of California natives that aren't fussy about drainage. You know, you've got your Yankee Point ceanothus, you got Howard McMinn manzanita. Well, this would be on that. The Canyon Snow, being usually called Pacific iris, it's a little more accurate, I suppose, than Douglas iris, because these are hybrids between at least four species of California native iris, one of which is Iris douglasiana, and there's other species involved in the parentage. So most people are calling them Pacific irises now, but Douglas iris was a name that stuck years ago. They have, like most irises, a fairly short bloom window in the spring, but it's spectacular, and the plants are attractive enough as long as they're not in blazing hot afternoon sun. Wouldn't worry too much about that in your situation, because your red barren peach should get 8 to 10 feet across and provide sufficient shade for them. Good drainage is important for them to a degree. Careful watering. Actually, they're really well adapted to what the peach tree will like, because the deep watering you'd be giving that with them on the margin of that would be just about perfect. So for color, I would do those. Those would be the ones I'd be having fun with if I were doing this project. The sedges are great. They could be good background plants, and you know, you're focusing on native plants. If you want to get a little more color in there and there's a non-native that you're okay with, Acorus, A-C-O-R-U-S, Ogon, O-G-O-N. And when you see that as part of the name, it means that it's got golden foliage. I've been working with a retirement center here for several years now on helping them with their landscape and putting plants in. We kept having these problem areas where the sprinkler system was just too much over in that corner, so it was always wet. It was heavy soil, very heavy soil out in this part of town. Everything that got planted would rot. So we finally took sedges and things like Acorus, which is just as tolerant of wet soil. And we just started lining the sidewalks with those, and they've been fine. This is a plant that is sold by my water plant suppliers. I mean, it can stand in water, can be used in the bog or on the edge of the bog or in your garden. So Acorus, and there's a bunch of different kinds, but the Ogon is particularly golden colored and spectacular. Could tolerate a wetter spot if there's an area like I'm seeing in your picture, for example, where the sidewalk is and water is draining down and sort of standing on the corner of the sidewalk. That'd be a great place for the Acorus. And the sedges would also be fine there. And these are all compatible. They'd all be things you could plant reasonably close together, and they would make a real nice sort of texture.
So looking at the first picture, the picture of the existing thing, I think I see a golden daisy bush behind it, mm-hmm. On the edge of the water there. And then is that yarrow? It looks like yarrow. Yeah, yarrow will take this, won't it?
Oh, yeah. Yarrow would take almost anything. Achillea, as a genus, the genus Achillea is one of the most useful groups of plants that we have for filling in around other natives. There's also a lot of non-native forms that are great in the garden. They attract butterflies, they attract beneficial insects of all kinds, and they do spread, some of them more vigorously than you were expecting. So be prepared for that. But I would think most of these sedges and things can hold their own. Just figure every 3 to 4 years, you're going to go in and dig things apart, do some fresh mulching, you know, pull out the things that have gotten excessive. And one of the things that's likely to get excessive would be any form of Achillea millefolium. There's a lot of garden hybrids. There's a lot of original species. You can go either direction, whatever you prefer. They're all very attractive to beneficial insects and very easy to grow. And the foliage looks nice all the time, even when they're not in bloom. The only thing about them is they get kind of floppy after the bloom. So it's a plant that takes real well to a quick mowing once a year. Whether you do that with pruners or an actual mower, doesn't bother me, but cleaning them up once every year or so is not a bad idea.
And the yarrow, it could be in the full sun, so it could be along the edge of the sidewalk there, in a couple of feet so it can sprawl.
Yeah.
But that would be a lovely thing, because with all the little butterflies and things, it would be great for people walking by to stop and go, ooh, what's that blue thing? And, you know, and entice the kids into learning botany.
It has fragrant foliage. So it's a very cool plant in that regard. So the key question is what you're going to do right on the sidewalk to keep water from flowing out from your garden, carrying your mulch and whatnot onto the sidewalk. And that's where digging a shallow trench, putting in a French drain, putting something that's a barrier. I mean, putting yarrow and acorus and such to block the water from flowing onto the sidewalk, channel it further down into whatever is off to the right of the picture that we can't see. The rendering was created using AI as a visualization tool, not as a substitute for local horticultural expertise. Okay, folks, you do understand that I'm very, very, very skeptical about AI for horticulture. It's okay to use it when you're sending us pictures. I think people are feeling a little guilty about it at this point.
Don't ask it questions for answers.
But right, but for design.
By all means, use it for designing your yard.
Yeah. And this has been true forever. I mean, I remember going to industry trade shows 25, 30 years ago about these new laptop computers people are going to have. Here's a design software you can use. And we'd see what they would generate. And the only problem with them was someone, a human, needs to then look at the plant selections and make sure they're actually appropriate. That the design part, the layout, the spacing was all fine. Plant selection could be a little bit improbable.
Well, Don always sends me pictures, and usually it's beautiful flowers, and this time it's the most rough-looking knife I've ever seen. What the heck have you been doing to that poor little thing? No. The picture is of bloody oranges?
Blood orange, please, not bloody oranges.
Well, they certainly look bloody to me. They're really dark red.
They are. They're beautiful. Blood oranges are... For the first couple of decades we were in business, the only people that ever asked me about blood oranges were people who had just returned from Italy or other parts of Europe or from the Levant. So Israel, Lebanon, places like that, where blood oranges have always been popular. They've been growing for 100, 200 years. It's a naturally occurring mutation, we assume, of a regular sweet orange that has much, much redder pigment to the flesh and frequently to the peel as well. And along with the much redder color, they often have a much more intense flavor than a regular orange. I mean, they're very powerfully flavored in the case of at least one of them. So people ask me, what's the best blood orange? There are three blood oranges that are common in the trade and in the United States anyway. Moro, Sanguinelli, and Tarocco. Tarocco is considered the original blood orange. It's a lighter crop yield, so my growers have never done that many of them. I have some planted here, but I haven't tasted them yet. I'll have to give you a report on that in a couple of years. Moro and Sanguinelli I planted 15 years ago. I just went back and checked my records this morning. And the two are very different in flavor profile, but they both do quite well here in the valley. Moro, which is what the picture is that I will probably use as the picture that goes along with this show at the KDRT page for Davis Garden Show. Moro is what's in the picture there. Intense red, very sweet, but high acidity. So packed with flavor, but powerfully packed with flavor. And most people who juice a blood orange like Moro will want to blend it with something that's a little milder. We'll find that blending it with blueberry juice, for example, is very good, or even blending it with regular orange juice. Because if you're drinking it straight, it's strong. It's very strong. Great for cooking. Makes fantastic tiramisu, for example. Sanguinelli, by comparison, is almost as red. The peel on my trees never gets as red as the Moro. So it's a little harder to tell, you know, when it's really finally blushing and getting ready to pick. To me, the Sanguinelli is like a navel orange with a little more flavor. It's not intensely flavored. A lot of people seem to prefer that because the Moro is so strongly flavored. So if you just happen to like blood oranges and you want to pick them off the tree and you want to peel them and eat them fresh, Sanguinelli will be your best choice. Moro's skin is tight. It doesn't peel as readily. If you want the full experience of a blood orange, Moro, M-O-R-O, Moro blood orange is the one for you. The other question I get is, how do you tell when they're ripe? Well, I get this question about all kinds of citrus, and the answer that I give is a little flippant. Keep trying. Pick them and try them and see how you feel about it, knowing when they're supposed to be ripe. So Moro is supposed to ripen in February. And I started picking in late January. I take one in, staff samples them. Yeah, these are good, but they're still pretty tart. February, they're getting sweeter, less tart. And by now, mid-February and to late February into early March, they're at the peak of perfection. So late February, early March in our region is when we pick the Moro blood orange. And one of the things I've noted is they do start to drop when they're ripe. So that's a good sign to me that, you know, maybe time to start picking them as well. Not all citrus do that. Citrus don't tell you when they're ripe. The color of the peel is temperature related, not related to the sugar content of the fruit or the acidity of the fruit. They turn color often well before they're ripe, in some cases, and others just when they are. Tangelos are a good example. They're beautiful right now, but they're really not ripe here until mid to late March. That's when they get sweeter and the acidity drops. People prefer them that way. So you just have to sample them. If you're a commercial grower, you'd be checking for the soluble solids content, but you'd also be sampling them because you want the acidity to drop to get that right balance. So late February into March is when blood oranges ripen. Yes, they do well here. They're just about as hardy as a navel orange. So going down to the mid 20s is no problem for them. My experience with the two side by side on the same rootstock, by the way, Moro is a slower growing, smaller tree. Sanguinelli is a bigger, more vigorous tree, higher yields. So that might attract some people. But the Moro, I've got about 150 fruit on the tree. It's 15 years old, and that's plenty. So we'll be fine with that. The Sanguinelli looks like it has more than that. But again, I think most people would be fine with either of them. The question is whether you want the full blood orange experience or just a hint of blood orange. I do have one other blood orange. An orange called Bukobza, B-O-U-K-H-O-B-Z-A, Bukobza. And it peels like a mandarin, but it's got bright red interior, usually, not always. It's not consistent about it. And the flavor is very, very distinctive. It's very hard to find. I stock them at my nursery because I really like it, but it's not one you're going to find quite readily if you're just calling around or driving around looking at nurseries. Bukobza is a blood orange, but to me, it's like a blood mandarin. I mean, it's got the advantage of being really easy to peel. People absolutely love it. The one thing I will say about it, though, I mentioned, it's not consistently red. I took one in and it had no red at all. Another one had a lot of pigment to it. So there are other blood oranges out there, but the three most common in the trade are the Moro, Sanguinelli, and here and there, the Tarraco. Tarraco is said to be a much bigger tree. I'll find out. I've got three of them planted, and it's said to be the best flavor of all. I'll let you know. We'll update this in 3 years.
All right. So we have a question. Arbor Vitae here. What is Arbor Vitae?
Common name is Thuya. This is becoming very frustrating to me. These are varieties of a evergreen conifer, I should be more specific, that is an East Coast native, and it has become extremely popular with some of the big mass marketers of landscape plants, like fastgrowingplants.com and sites like that. There's a new housing development that's going in Davis, Bretton Woods, if you all know where that is. And I've got a couple, I've got a staff person who's doing consulting out there, and I've got a customer who's doing landscape contracting out there, and they're watching hundreds of these things go in. And these are small yards, and they're planting this Arbor Vitae or Thuya, 3 foot spacing all the way around the backyard.
How tall does this thing get?
Well, hopefully they get the right one. If they get emerald green, then it gets to 10 to 12 feet. If they get green giant, then it gets 30 to 40 feet. And they look pretty identical in the nursery, so I hope they're getting properly labeled materials. Emerald is become very popular because it's being touted for, quote, drought tolerance. I've got to say something about this. This is a hybrid from the East Coast Thuya. It's drought tolerance in the East Coast is a different thing than drought tolerance in California.
It means it didn't rain this afternoon.
Right, like 2 weeks without rain. We're joking, but I mean, so, drought tolerance in Georgia is a different thing than drought tolerance in California. Here, if we say drought tolerant, people often think, I can go all summer without irrigating this. No.
The interesting thing is the map. And this map shows where emerald green Arbor Vitae grows. And almost the entire United States is emerald green. I mean, it's green from the Canada border all the way down. Well, there's a part on the coast of Texas.
Yep.
And in Florida is not included. Those are gray areas. And then the Central Valley of California.
That's correct. So that's
grow here.
That's from a legitimate site called instanthedge.com, which has a great map that shows the emerald green Arbor Vitae growing regions. They're saying USDA zones 3 through 8, but that's not the relevant part. It's not a temperature thing. The arid west with low rainfall, these are not going to work. And what frustrates me about this, We went through this with the Leylandii cypress 40 years ago, 50 years ago, the newest, greatest, latest thing. Look at this incredible plant. Look how fast it grows. Look how drought tolerant it is. And then 7 to 10 years in after planting, Leylandii cypresses always get a canker disease and die. They do not succeed in the hot, dry interior here in Northern California. I'm told that's true elsewhere, but I know for sure it's true here. So this is the latest conifer that's come along. That's the latest, greatest, newest thing. Look at all these places it can grow. Doesn't grow here. We've got a big development firm planting hundreds of these in a high-density housing development here in Davis. So I just wanted to call this out because I'm seeing these in nurseries. Okay, you stick one in the corner of your yard, fine. I'm not real concerned about one that's part of
it. And eventually it dies and you replace it.
Or you've already put something else in with it, perhaps. Yeah, like our strong recommendation, if you're planting what you're thinking of as a hedge, don't plant one thing the whole way around. Do one of this and three of that and do one of something else. And so if you've done one or two of them that way, fine. We'll see how it goes. But my guess is these will not last more than 7 to 10 years because that's the typical pattern with these hybrid conifers. Keep in mind that most conifers need at least 40 inches of rainfall a year. Okay, we get 20, and they need irrigation consistently. And many of them, if it gets above 90 degrees, 100 degrees regularly, will be stressed. And when they get stressed, they get attacked by bacterial disease, particularly bacterial canker disease, a couple different, and in some cases, fungus disease. Then the dieback begins. And they take 3 to 5 years to die. And people go into nurseries and they're being told they're overwatering or underwatering or whatever. No, it's an unsuitable plant for our climate. And yet hundreds of them are being planted right now. As a side note, I stopped in a Walmart garden center in Dixon. If you're a plant professional, that can be a very entertaining thing to do because, well, Walmart is the largest purveyor of plants in the United States, surely by magnitude because of how big they are. The plants in there can be very interesting. They're typically not regionally appropriate. And the only hedge plants they had on display at the Walmart garden center in Dixon were Leylandii cypress and emerald green arborvitae. Okay, neither of them are things that should be planted in our area. And I wish the information would get out there to the buyers at some of these places. I don't think Walmart garden centers actually even have buyers technically anymore. I think they just have a relationship with a wholesale grower who decides what's in there. So don't take their presence at your local big box store as being an indication that it necessarily grows in your region. Do your own research at that point, as we like to say. But this one in particular, it's getting promoted very heavily. If you go on to Google and you think, I'm going to look up good hedge ideas, this is going to pop up first because the paid advertisers are the ones that are selling this, fastgrowingplants.com and so forth. Dig in a little deeper. They're being honest about it. They're not telling you it grows here. They sell nationwide, so they're not doing anything particularly dishonest. But this one concerns me because I have actually seen this being sold at some local nurseries, but especially the chains that sell landscape plants. So you're kind of on your own at some of those places. I'm going to briefly editorialize here. Of the three big ones, Walmart, Home Depot, Lowe's. I go into them. I look at their garden departments. The one that's been most consistently reasonably good has been Lowe's. They appear to have some local authority for buying. The store manager may have some authority. I can't really tell. A lot of stuff comes in out of Oregon and places where there's bigger nurseries that are big enough to provide them with the numbers that they need. But generally speaking, I haven't been horrified by what I've seen at Lowe's. They're good and they're good quality. Home Depot, it's much more variable because they'll get a manager who's good and they do appear to have some latitude about buying locally and so forth. So Home Depot, if you find one and the staff seems knowledgeable and the stuff looks, you know, you look it up and it seems like it's regionally appropriate, they probably are fine. When I was in the Nursery Association, you know, when I was active in the State Nursery Association, Home Depot was just coming into California in a big way. Their managers would join our association. And that was pretty controversial at the time. And we found these are people who were good managers. They'd gone to Home Depot to work at a nursery because that's where they could get a job. Many of them became really integral parts of the Nursery Association. So Home Depot is more variable. Walmart, terrible. Okay, just consistently terrible. Yeah, I don't know how else to put it. I was fascinated by what they had on display and very amused by it, but I just do not see good plant selections for sure. Don't do your landscape decisions there. If you need some quick color, the prices are good, quality is fine, but everything else, no, I was definitely not impressed. So that's my editorializing on the big box emporium that try to sell you plants. Lowe's best, Home Depot, variable, Walmart, terrible.
So back to Emerald Green.
Yes, thank you.
No, seriously, we have listeners all over. So I want to do this.
This place is
when
warm.
I look the green for most of the country, and then in California, not in the Central Valley, not on the coast, Northern California. So from the Bay Area on up, no.
Yep.
And then down below the Tehachapi Mountains, down in any of the dry desert areas, including LA and San Diego, no. It's all gray. And it goes into the southern deserts of Arizona.
Yeah, the Southwest is just not going to work for these. They're not tolerant of drought. That's the main thing. They're also not tolerant of extreme heat. And that's what we have. I'm told that in rainier climates, you may run into spider mite problems and sometimes bagworms and things, you know, scale insects. Those are local problems that you might encounter on them. My guess is there's a lot of places where this is a perfectly fine landscape shrub that would give good privacy.
As 90% of the country.
Yeah, good portion of the country, yes. So one of the problems is that you'll often see on the label USDA zone listing, and it's a little confusing. This one says USDA zones 3 through 8. Well, we're in zone 9, the coast is zone 10. So it happens to be accurate in this case. But the USDA zones, remember, are just temperature. They don't have anything to tell you about the humidity, the rainfall, the other factors that are in many cases more important. In this particular case, I think it's our low humidity and extremely high temperatures and dense soils just lead to problems with a lot of conifers. There's a handful of conifers that do well here in the valley. Italian cypress, you know, the real stiff upright thing that you see in cemeteries, they do great. I've seen them without irrigation at all in the Sacramento Valley. They're from Italy. So conifers from Mediterranean climates are likely to work in our part of California. But for the most part, this isn't really a place where we have a lot of these conifers. That's why we use the broadleaf evergreens when we want privacy. We use, you know, boxwood for shorter hedges, but xylosma, photinia, toyon, things like that. Ceanothus, if you're in the right zones for those. These are broadleaf evergreens, non-conifer evergreens that will provide the privacy you're after. And as with anything, our industry is notorious for overselling certain plants, and then we sell millions of them and people use them. Photinia, Fraser Eye, India Hawthorn, you know, which when I opened my nursery, where every nursery had huge displays of those. Well, you plant that many of something, some disease or pest problem is likely to come along and damage that something. And so if you have more diversity, which is one of our key principles here at the Davis Garden Show, if you have more diversity, you're less likely to be have your hedge wiped out when the one disease comes along or the dieback proves to be an issue. You've still got other things in there that can fill in. It's better if your hedge is a living, breathing population of plants, not a clipped line of one species.
Well, Don gets interesting things sent to him. And in this case, one of our listeners mailed him with the postal mail,
yes,
a couple of sheets from the Gardening with the Old Farmer's Almanac, and so that he would have them for garden quotes. So thank you, Kathy, for sending us this stuff. And we will, in fact, use one today. Gardens are not made by sitting in the shade. And that was said by Rudyard Kipling, an English writer.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.